I did not prepare a formal introduction for Jeremy because I doubt there's a person here who doesn't pretty much know his story. At one point or another, as it continued to grow over a few years. We're going to turn the time over to him. I wanted to let you know that he has his presentation broken down into kind of two separate sections, and he'll just segue into the second section, I think, probably with explaining what it is he's doing. And then we will have the Q&A afterwards. All right, your time's yours, Jeremy.
All right. I love stories. There's power in stories. On the night that the church made the fatal mistake of excommunicating John DeLand, John said, "Before we tell our stories, we sit alone in darkness, suffering, thinking that we are the only ones, thinking we are crazy, feeling broken. But there's power in story. In telling our stories, we decide to come out of the darkness, to come out of our closets. In telling our stories, we begin the journey of discovering and revealing our authentic selves. The journey of authenticity and self-discovery and self-empowerment often begins with the telling of a story. So I'm going to share a story today, my story, my journey. I'm 8 years old. I'm singing I am a child of God enough times to make my brothers punch me. I don't walk into the baptismal font. I basically cannonball dive in. I'm given a bunch of those storybooks and picture books. I've read them several times. I'm 12 years old. My dad ordains me a deacon. I pass the sacrament for the first time, and I am 7 feet tall because I now have more authority than the Pope. I'm now 14. My dad ordains me a teacher. I feel grown up as I collect fast offerings in the neighborhood. I'm nervous but excited about my trip to the LA Temple to do baptism for the dead. I prepare for the day and I take it very seriously. After all those poor souls waiting centuries to be released from spirit prison so that, well, I can release them. My hearing blessing with the general authority. I receive my witness. I know with every fiber of my being that the church is true. I know without a doubt that my hearing will be restored any day. That was the faith that I had. School's out, and I'm at BYU in Provo, Utah, for EFY. I counted the days till I got here. I stopped counting when I was here. I shared my testimony. I devoured all the workshops, all the talks. I don't want to go back home. I'm 16 now. My dad ordains me a priest. Things are even more serious now that I can prepare and bless the sacrament. I'm an overnight germaphobe, and I keep telling the other priests to wash their hands. I'm one of the older kids now. Seminary, I laugh at the kids complaining about getting up early. I get up earlier. I drove 30 miles every day to 60 miles round trip to Irvine, California. The seminary is close to my high school, so I got up earlier. I was committed. All those road shows, mutual, state dances, firesides. Melchizedek priesthood at 18 years old. Now I have the real power. Training wheels are off. I can now carry olive oil on my keychain. Endowment in the San Diego Temple. I'm nervous. I'm excited. I don't have a problem with the weird stuff. The church is true. Just own it. I'm a senior in high school with a few months left until graduation. I'm walking around to classes in my undergarments. I let my Mormon friends see the smile, you know, just to make them jealous. I've read the Book of Mormon twice. I've I'm about done with the Doctrine and Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price. I've read hundreds of church and gospel-related books, all from approved sources, of course. I devour all the church magazines and church talks that I can. I invite my girlfriend and friends to watch general conference with me at my house, as well as to attend all the stake activities and dances with me. Mission call. You are hereby called to serve as a missionary. You are assigned to labor in the New York North Mission. You are to teach the gospel in American Sign Language. That's it. The prophet has spoken. I'm in Vermont, the place of the prophet Joseph Smith's birth. It's really true that Vermont has green mountains. I'm on a church history tour with my family. A few days earlier, I was in Salem, Massachusetts, where Joseph had his leg operation. No alcohol, of course. I'm in Fayette, New York, at the Whitmer Farm, where the church was organized and restored. The Book of Mormon translation took place here. No mention of a rock in a hat. No mention of treasure hunting. This is also the place where the three witnesses saw the gold plates that were in use for the Book of Mormon that we have today. No mention of this either. No mention of second sight. I'm in the Sacred Grove in Palmyra. I walk around in the woods imagining what it might have been like for the prophet Joseph Smith. No mention of multiple first vision accounts nor their contradictions. No mention of the first account was written 12 years after the event supposedly happened. I see the location where the Book of Mormon was published. I visit the newly built Palmyra Temple. I'm at the Hill Cumorah, not the other Hill Cumorah in Mesoamerica, for those apologists listening in. It's the Hill Cumorah, you know, the one that Joseph Smith and the church points to. I'm mesmerized by the pageant. I'm very annoyed with the anti-Mormons and their lies on the road by the pageant. I'm in Harmony, Pennsylvania, the place where Joseph met his first of many wives, Emma, when he was on a treasure hunting expedition. The place where the priesthood was restored or backdated. I'm not told the details, of course. This is also the place where part of the Book of Mormon was translated with Oliver Cowdery. I'm in Hiram, Ohio, at the Johnson Home, where Joseph continued his translation of the Bible, and where he received the revelation for the DNC 76 degrees the degrees of glory. I'm now in Kirtland, Ohio. Lots of history here. I visit the Kirtland Temple, the new O.K. Whitney store, School of the Prophets, a bunch of homes. I learn about the RLDS Church as they own the Kirtland Temple and some other properties. No mention of the secret polygamy and polyandry that took place here, nor the fraud of the Kirtland Safety Society Bank. No mention of a lot so not so positive things. I'm in Nauvoo. Lots of history here, too. I see the newly built Nauvoo Temple that's still being constructed. I see a lot of homes of the leaders of the time, including Joseph Smith's mansion. I visit Heber C. Kimball's home. No mention about the test Joseph gave him for his wife. No mention of Helen Mar Kimball or all the other secret polygamy and polyandry that took place here. No mention of the Nauvoo Expositor, or that Joseph's order to destroy it is what led him to Carthage. I'm in the Carthage jail. I feel the bullet holes on the door. I imagine what took place here. No mention of a smuggled gun. No mention of Joseph shooting three men on his way out. I'm now in Independence, Missouri, where the temple lot is. I'm fascinated by the presence of different branches of Mormonism here. I'm fascinated by the RLDS, interesting temple. I'm now at Liberty Jail, where Joseph was imprisoned during the Mormon War. I'm inspired by DNC 121. I'm now in Adamon Day Amen. I'm imagining the great meeting that will take place here in the future for the second coming, before the second coming. On the flight home, I wrote in my journal about the trip. This trip really strengthened my testimony of the restoration. I love Joseph Smith. I know he was a modern day witness of the Savior. I appreciate him for doing his duty and mission. I know the church is true. I know the Book of Mormon is true. The church history tour that I took was operated and run by CES teachers, two of them, who have been in the CES system since 1982. I talked with one of the men later who admitted that he knew several of the issues and problems at the time of the tour, and he apologized to me for not sharing them. The question I ask is, why did he fear disclosing the ugly facts to us? What was it about the truth that he was afraid of? What is it about the church and its culture that kept him from being honest to us about the real history and the real Joseph Smith? I arrive home from a tour and immediately get set apart as a missionary that night. I leave for the missionary training center in Provo the very next morning. You can imagine how disorienting that was. I give all my heart, mind, and strength on my mission. It really is a labor of love for me. I believe in what I am doing out here in New York City. The planes hit the tower. This changes everything. It changes me profoundly. I read all the standard works, all the standard books, at least twice. Jesus the Christ, A Marvelous Work and Wonder, A Search for Happiness, Truth Restored, Articles of Faith, Miracle of Forgiveness, which was requested by the mission president. I mastered the missionary scripture program. I want more. I asked my family to send me some Hubie Nubley books. I read them. I'm a serious student of the gospel. I want to know everything I can about the gospel and the church. I return with honor. I'm in Israel. I'm studying the life of the Savior in the Holy Land, Jerusalem, the Sea of Galilee, the Garden of Gethsemane, the tomb. I see the New Testament with new eyes as I walk this land. I'm in Egypt. I'm captivated by this place. The pyramids, the Valley of the Kings, the mystery that envelopes this place. There was a man there who makes papyri for LDS tourists in which he copies the Book of Abraham facsimiles. I bought all three facsimiles. Coolest souvenirs ever. And yes, men's penis was in one of them. I can see Tanner is wondering about that. I'm at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. I take extra religious classes just because I can and want to. I'm going to help a girl there get her MRS degree. It took several girls and a bunch of dates to find her, but I found her in a Wilkinson Center one day at lunch. You can almost hear the John, by the way, Wilkinson Center song as I say this. I'm in the San Diego Temple. It's my wedding day. Across the altar, in the ceiling room, is the most beautiful girl I've ever seen. Damn it. So much love, so much hope for the future. I'm now in the mountains of southern Utah, a place that I love very much, way up there near beautiful Zion. It's a place of peace that I visit often. I'm staring at the fire under a very clear and starry night, far, far from the city lights that totally absorbed me with darkness, except for the fire and the stars. My Mormon paradigm is shattered. The CES letter is now viral on the internet. My name and face is out there with it. I'm terrified of the unknown future, All I know is that things are never going to be the same again. Overwhelmed, I lay my head down on my sleeping bag to focus on the stars. It is wonderful to lay back and see what you can see. To lay on your back and look at the stars as you go way, way back in time. What does each individual star represent? What could each individual star tell us if they could speak? What could each individual star show us if we could really see? What feelings could each individual star convey if we could feel? What wisdom, knowledge, and experience could each individual star impart to us? Is there life as we know it near any of these stars? Is there life as we don't know it near any of these stars? How many planetary systems are there like ours? Are some of them life-supporting planets? Does God live near one of these stars? Does God occupy all the stars? Is there a God? Are we gods? Do any of our ancestors live near the stars? Are they now part of the stars? Will we someday return to the stars? As we wonder about everything, it is good to wonder, you know. As I lay there that dark night, lit by the fire and the stars, I begin to drift asleep and start to dream. I was asked a couple months ago by the good folks with the Ex-Mormon Foundation what the title of my talk was going to be. After some brainstorming and back and forth with titles like The One Weird Trick to Get Mormon Apologists to Hate You, for those of you that can't read it, I guess it says, local deaf man learns how to save himself and others 10% and an extra Saturday every week using this one weird trick. I also thought another topic, tapers, the world's most majestic horses. I decided to focus on a topic that is extremely meaningful and very important to me. The exam of life, restoring your own power and liberty. I confess that it's not completely original. I kind of borrowed it from a well-known guy by the name of Socrates, whose great quote is, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Socrates was a pretty interesting guy who didn't mince words. Notice that he doesn't say the unexamined life is less meaningful or that the unexamined life is one way to live. No, he very boldly and simply says it's not even worth living. To live an examined life is to live a life asking the hard questions. It's to live a life where nothing is taboo or too sacred to question. In an examined life, there are no dark nook and crannies that are off limits to scrutiny. To live an examined life is to force yourself out of a zombie trance. A zombie trance is what I call that state of consciousness, where we're just wandering around on autopilot, allowing tradition and others to dictate or counsel us on what to think, believe, or value. An examined life forces us to live our lives consciously. It forces us not only to look in the mirror, but to look so deeply it startles us. It is only by true self-discovery and true self-awareness that we can find our most authentic selves. And that authenticity is what makes life well worth living. Many of us, if not most of us here today, have heard or even said the following mantra over and over and over in our years of church experience. I know. To me, these two words, I know, are perhaps the most destructive words I have ever personally uttered as a believer. To me, they're dangerous. Those two words effectively shut down worlds of awe and wonder and discovery that have only in recent years opened back up. Possibilities and imagination that have only in recent years became possible. It was only when I started saying, I don't know, that I began to experience real awe and wonder and discovery again. I love the story of the Zen master and the cup of tea. Once, a long time ago, there was a wise Zen master. People from far and near would seek him for his wisdom. Many would come and ask him to teach them, enlighten them in the way of Zen. He seldom turned any away. One day, an important man, a man used to command and obedience, came to visit the master. I have come today to ask you to teach me about Zen. Open my mind to enlightenment. The tone of the important man's voice was one used to getting his own way. The Zen master smiled and said they should discuss the matter over a cup of tea. When the tea was served, the master poured his visitor a cup. He poured and he poured, and the tea rose and rose to the rim and began to spill over the table and onto the robes of the man. The visitor shouted, "Enough! You are spilling the tea all over. Can't you see the cup is full?" The master stopped pouring and smiled at his guest. "You are like this teacup, so full that nothing more can be added. Come back to me when the cup is empty. Come back to me with an open mind." It is only through real humility and letting go of what we know, or what we think we know, that true wisdom can pour in. Here's a pie that I like to call pie of ignorance. There's what we know that we know, there's what we know that we don't know, and there's what we don't know that we don't know. This is the danger of saying, "I know." This is one of the dangers of religious certainty. It blocks you from not only not seeing the orange, but it also removes any incentive and motivation to really freely explore and discover the orange in your life. The only way that the orange can truly be discovered and perhaps shifted to green is by humbly saying, "I don't know. I'm seeking to discover and to understand." Peter Bakhazian said, "Faith taints, or at worst, removes our curiosity faith taints, or at worst, removes our curiosity about the world, what we should value, and what type of life we should lead. Faith replaces wonder with epistemological arrogance disguised as false humility. Faith immutably alters the starting conditions for inquiry by uprooting a hunger to know and by sowing a warrantless confidence. For me and for many of us, climbing out of Mormonism was the most humbling experience of my life. I wanted the church to be true. In fact, I think for many of us at the time, we needed the church to be true. Yet we valued what's really true more, and we went through the agonizing but ultimately liberating experience of emptying our cups to make room. And this has made all the difference. Julia Galef gave some great metaphors that are very important and relevant to these points. In her Why You Think You're Right, Even If You're Wrong TED Talk, she talks about two very different mindsets and ways of looking at the world.
So, I'd like you to imagine for a moment that you're a soldier in the heat of battle. Maybe you're a Roman foot soldier, or a medieval archer, or maybe you're a Zulu warrior. Regardless of your time and place, there are some things that are constant. Your adrenaline is elevated, and your actions are stemming from these deeply ingrained reflexes, reflexes rooted in a need to protect yourself and your side, and to defeat the enemy. So now, I'd like you to imagine playing a very different role, that of the scout. So the scout's job is not to attack or defend. The scout's job is to understand. The scout is the one going out, mapping the terrain, identifying potential obstacles. And the scout may hope to learn that, say, there's a bridge in a convenient location across a river. But above all, the scout wants to know what's really there as accurately as possible. And in a real, actual army, both the soldier and the scout are essential. But you can also think of each of these roles as a mindset, a metaphor for how all of us process information and ideas in our daily lives. And what I'm going to argue today is that having good judgment, making accurate predictions, making good decisions, is mostly about which mindset you're in.
Julia then goes on to talk about an example of these two mindsets, that of the soldier and that of the scout in action. I'm going to skip this example to move over to the other relevant point of a TED Talk.
So to me, Picard is a poster child for what I call scout mindset. It's the drive not to make one idea win or another lose, but just to see what's really there as honestly and accurately as you can, even if it's not pretty or convenient or pleasant. And this mindset is what I'm personally passionate about, and what I've spent the last few years examining and trying to figure out what causes scout mindset. You know, why are some people, sometimes at least, able to cut through their own prejudices and biases and motivations and just try to see the facts and the evidence as objectively as they can? And the answer is emotional. So just as soldier mindset is rooted in emotions like defensiveness or tribalism, scout mindset is too. It's just rooted in different emotions. So for example, scouts are curious. They're more likely to say that they feel pleasure when they learn new information or an itch to solve a puzzle. They're more likely to feel intrigued when they encounter something that contradicts their expectations. Scouts also have different values. They're more likely to say that they think it's virtuous to test your own beliefs, and they're less likely to say that someone who changes his mind seems weak. And above all, scouts are grounded, which means that their self-worth as a person isn't tied to how right or wrong they are about any particular topic. So, you know, they can believe that capital punishment works, and if studies come out showing that it doesn't, they can say, huh, looks like I might be wrong. Doesn't mean I'm bad or stupid, you know? So these traits, this cluster of traits, is what researchers have found, and I've also found anecdotally, predicts good judgment. And the key takeaway I want to leave you with about those traits is that they're primarily not about how smart you are or about how much you know. In fact, they don't correlate very much with IQ at all. They're about how you feel. So there's a quote that I keep coming back to by Saint-Exupéry. He's the author of The Little Prince. And he said, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up your men to collect wood and give orders and distribute the work. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. In other words, I claim If we want to really improve our judgment as individuals and as societies, what we need most is not more instruction in logic or rhetoric or probability or economics, even though those things are quite valuable. But what we most need to use those principles well is scout mindset. We need to change the way we feel. We need to learn how to feel proud instead of ashamed when we notice we might have been wrong about something. We need to learn how to feel intrigued instead of defensive when we encounter some information that contradicts our beliefs. So the question I want to leave you with is, what do you most yearn for? Do you yearn to defend your own beliefs? Or do you yearn to see the world as clearly as you possibly can? Thank you.
Julia's talk is an excellent talk. I highly recommend that you check out her talk on TED. Living an examined life compels us to take a closer look at our default settings. Do we operate by default on a soldier mindset, where we automatically defend the status quo and tradition and beliefs handed to us? Or do we operate by default on a scout mindset, where we're seeking new information and celebrating when we discover our beliefs and ideas are wrong? Living an examined life pushes us to make a decision as to whether we want to live a faith-based life or an evidence-based life. It asks us to determine for ourselves which approach brings us closer to truth and reality. Years ago, I read a book that captivated my imagination. It was a book called Flatland, a romance of many dimensions, written in 1884 by Edwin Abbott. For those of you who are unfamiliar with this book and its ideas, here's a quick and awesome overview.
We live in a three-dimensional world where everything has length, width, and height. But what if our world were two-dimensional? We would be squashed down to occupy a single plane of existence, geometrically speaking, of course. And what would that world look and feel like? This is the premise of Edwin Abbott's 1884 novella, Flatland. Flatland is a fun mathematical thought experiment that follows the trials and tribulations of a square exposed to the third dimension. But what is a dimension anyway? For our purposes, a dimension is a direction, which we can picture as a line. For our direction to be a dimension, it has to be at right angles to all other dimensions. So a one-dimensional space is just a line. A two-dimensional space is defined by two perpendicular lines, which describe a flat plane, like a piece of paper. And a three-dimensional space adds a third perpendicular line, which gives us height and the world we're familiar with. So what about four dimensions, and five, and 11? Where do we put these new perpendicular lines? This is where Flatland can help us. Let's look at our square protagonist's world. Flatland is populated by geometric shapes, ranging from isosceles triangles to equilateral triangles to squares, pentagons, hexagons, all the way up to circles. These shapes are all scurrying around a flat world, living their flat lives. They have a single eye on the front of their faces, and let's see what the world looks like from their perspective. What they see is essentially one dimension, a line. But in Abbott's Flatland, closer objects are brighter, and that's how they see depth. So a triangle looks different from a square, looks different from a circle, and so on. Their brains cannot comprehend the third dimension. In fact, they vehemently deny its existence because it's simply not part of their world or experience. But all they need, as it turns out, is a little boost. One day, a sphere shows up in Flatland to visit our square hero. Here's what it looks like when the sphere passes through Flatland from the square's perspective. And this blows his little square mind. Then, the sphere lifts the square into the third dimension, the height direction where no Flatlander has gone before, and shows him his world. From up here, the square can see everything, the shapes of buildings, all the precious gems hidden in the earth, and even the insides of his friends, which is probably pretty awkward. Once the hapless square comes to terms with the third dimension, he begs his host to help him visit the fourth and higher dimensions. But the sphere bristles at the mere suggestion of dimensions higher than three and exiles the square back to Flatland. Now, the sphere's indignation is understandable. The fourth dimension is very difficult to reconcile with our experience of the world. Short of being lifted into the fourth dimension by a visiting hypercube, we can't experience it. But we can get close. You'll recall that when the sphere first visited the second dimension, he looked like a series of circles that started as a point when he touched Flatland, grew bigger until he was halfway through, and then shrank smaller again. We can think of this visit as a series of 2D cross-sections of a 3D object. Well, we can do the same thing in the third dimension with a four-dimensional object. Let's say that a hypersphere is the 4D equivalent of a 3D sphere. When the 4D object passes through the third dimension, it'll look something like this. Let's look at one more way of representing a four-dimensional object. Let's say we have a point, a zero-dimensional shape. Now we extend it out 1 inch, and we have a one-dimensional line segment. Extend the whole line segment by 1 inch, and we get a 2D square. Take the whole square and extend it out 1 inch, and we get a 3D cube. You can see where we're going with this. Take the whole cube and extend it out 1 inch, this time perpendicular to all three existing directions, and we get a 4D hypercube, also called a tesseract. For all we know, there could be four-dimensional life forms somewhere out there, occasionally poking their heads into our bustling 3D world and wondering what all the fuss is about. In fact, there could be whole other four-dimensional worlds beyond our detection, hidden from us forever by the nature of our perception. Doesn't that blow your little spherical mind?
So, imagine that the square, imagine being that square after being exposed to a higher dimension and a higher level of thinking. Imagine trying to explain what you know to your fellow flatlanders. Imagine your flatlander family and friends shaming you by labeling you anti-flatland. For daring to suggest that there are higher dimensional universes than the familiar flatland universe that they insist is the one and only true universe. There are a lot of parallels between flatland and the Mormon transitionary experience. Like any dimension, the flatland has its own laws, traditions, customs, culture, language, and ways of thinking. When viewed through three-dimensional eyes, flatland looks very simple, even primitive. What if we took the flatland metaphor and applied it to our own world? What if instead of viewing flatland as strictly a separate physical dimension, we view flatland as a way of thinking, as a model of the world that is held by some of our fellow humans on this very same planet? What might the characteristics and culture of flatland on Earth look like? Tells you what to think, what to believe, what is approved and not approved, what to wear, sometimes down to your underwear, where you can watch and cannot watch, where you can listen and cannot listen to, where you can read and cannot read, where you can consume and what you cannot consume, what percentage of your money and time should be given and how it should be given, when you are worthy and when you are not worthy. What about language and phrases? What might some of their claims look like? Doubt your doubts. What would a three-dimensional thinking encounter be? Cherish your doubts. Explore your doubts. Resolve your doubts. Doubt is the beginning to knowledge and wisdom. Stay in the boat. What would a three-dimensional encounter be? The boat is obsolete. Get off the boat and go hang out at the beach. Some things that are true are not very useful. Censorship and withholding of critical information is morally wrong. I know. Doubt is uncomfortable. Certainty is ridiculous. It is wrong to criticize leaders even if the criticism is true. A 3D response would be, listening to our dear leader's testimony in your own voice will bring you the witness you seek. A 3D response would be, listening, without us, where will you go? What will you do? I know this is kind of old now, but 3D response, get off the training wheels. Anti-flatlanders live in a polar night of icy darkness. The 3D response would be, the best place to view the real heavens is in the polar night of icy darkness. Obedience brings blessings. 3D response would be, disobedience is the true foundation of liberty. The obedient must be slaves. The late Christopher Hitchens employed his audience, take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way. It is only by recognizing and rejecting two-dimensional thinking that you can rise to the liberation and freedom of higher dimensional thinking. Another dangerous two-dimensional thinking and model of the world is the sacrifice of right now and today for the future. By future, I don't mean next week or 5 years from now. I mean life after death. In other words, sacrificing what is provable right now and what you can see and feel right now for something that you cannot prove, cannot see, cannot feel, in which you base on faith. In two-dimensional thinking, some call this enduring to the end. Sometimes there's variations of this statement, like the tears you shed now will be rewarded in heaven. This kind of thinking can keep extremely unhappy people in extremely unhappy marriages. I can't violate my temple covenants by leaving him. She's not perfect now, but will be perfect after the resurrection and in the eternities. This kind of thinking allows people to think that the answers will come after death and that it's their job to endure to the end with heavy shelves and heavy cognitive dissonance. To me, this is an insane path as the answers are available right now. Ironically, the seeker only needs to ask and they shall receive through the veil of Google. I have found that the single most important question that one can ask themselves when trying to decide on whether or not to really investigate the LDS Church's truth claims is a single question. What if it's not true? What a powerful question. What a powerful reframe. What if? What if I don't have to die to get answers to my heavy shelf? What if the church is really a man-made institution like other religions? What if the church wasn't true? How would I know? What if Joseph Smith was a 19th century Warren Jeffs? What if there are no prophets, seers, and revelators? What if I could live an authentic life true to myself and not what 15 old men in Salt Lake tell me I should? What if I don't have to rationalize and excuse viral things like polygamy, polyandry, racism, sexism, despicable violence in scriptures, fraud, billion-dollar malls and real estate deals backed by the widow's mite, bigotry, and anything else that offends your conscience and soul? What if I reclaimed my own authority and stopped giving it away? What if? What if? What if? Think of the worlds that these questions open up to. Think of the possibilities and doors opened because of targeted questions that you can ask yourself today, right now. For most of my life, I adopted the endure to the end model of life installed in me by Mormonism, a journey that I had to endure and get through. I looked at life as merely a stepping stone to eternity, a test that I had to slog through and pass in order to get to my real life in the eternities. All that time, not being present, focused on the future that never existed, as I was always in the now. After all there is and ever can be is right now, and now, and now, and now.
The existence, the physical universe, is basically playful. There is no necessity for it whatsoever. It isn't going anywhere. That is to say, it doesn't have some destination that it ought to arrive at. But it is best understood by analogy with music. Because music, as an art form, is essentially playful. We say you play the piano. You don't work the piano. Why? Music differs from, say, travel. When you travel, you are trying to get somewhere. In music, though, one doesn't make the end of a composition the point of the composition. If that were so, the best conductors would be those who played fastest. And there would be composers who wrote only finales. People go to a concert just to hear one crashing chord, because that's the end. Same way in dancing. You don't aim at a particular spot in the room. That's where you should arrive. The whole point of the dancing is the dance. Now, but we don't see that as something brought by our education into our everyday conduct. We've got a system of schooling which gives a completely different impression. It's all graded. And what we do is we put the child into the corridor of this grade system with a kind of, come on, kitty, kitty, kitty. And yeah, you go to kindergarten, you know. And that's a great thing, because when you finish that, you'll get into first grade. And then, come on, first grade leads to second grade and so on. And then you get out of grade school, you go to high school, and it's revving up. The thing is coming. Then you're going to go to college. And by Jove, then you get into graduate school. And when you're through with graduate school, you go out to join the world. And then you get into some racket where you're selling insurance. And they've got that quota to make. And you're going to make that. And all the time, the thing is coming. It's coming. It's coming. That great thing, the success you're working for. Then when you wake up one day about 40 years old, you say, my God, I've arrived. I'm there. And you don't feel very different from what you always felt. Look at the people who live to retire and put those savings away. And then when they're 65, they don't have any energy left, they're more or less impotent, and they go and rot in an old people's, senior citizens' community. Because we've simply cheated ourselves the whole way down the line. We thought of life by analogy with a journey, with a pilgrimage, which had a serious purpose at the end, and the thing was to get to that end. Success or whatever it is, or maybe heaven after you're dead. But we missed the point the whole way along. It was a musical thing, and you were supposed to sing or to dance while the music was being played.
He taught me the courage of stars before you left. how light carries on endlessly, even after death. The shortness of breath, I'll explain the infinite, how rare and beautiful it truly is that we exist.
It is always now. Sing and dance. It is always now. There is no journey. There is no destination. We live in a current reality that is based on authority and power. The way that the church retains its authority can be summed up in three words: illusion of authority. The only way that this illusion of authority prop stays up is because the members of the church buy into the illusion. When the majority of the members stop accepting the illusion of authority perpetuated by the top leadership, you guys like that slide, huh? I don't know if that kind of looks like Thomas Monson, but I don't know. When the majority of members stop accepting the illusion of authority perpetuated by their top leadership, the game is over. The greatest threat to the church's illusion of authority are the ones who are pointing out the illusion. The ones who are pointing to the emperor and saying that he has no clothes. This is why the church is absolutely obsessed with painting those that leave as bitter apostates, who have lost the light and whose lives will collapse without the church. This is why the church excommunicates people like the September 6th, John DeLand, Kate Kelly, Rock Waterman, Carter Woods, among others. This is why the church attempted to excommunicate me, but couldn't, because I excommunicated them first. This is why the church tells its members that they can leave, but they can't leave it alone. The church needs us to leave it alone. They need to discredit us in order to preserve their illusion of authority. Authority and the perception of authority is an extremely important thing in life. We make or break our lives by how we handle authority or our perception of it. The greatest safeguard against being duped and against being brainwashed and against being taken advantage of is to never surrender your authority. Never give another person authority over you and over your life. Own yourself. Own your authority. Own your power. There is no higher power or authority. There is no higher authority in your life than yourself. Stop giving it away. As you watch this, think about the church and what's currently happening to the church's illusion of authority. Think about your own struggle and experience in discovering the church's truth crisis.
Christoph, let me ask you, why do you think that Truman has never come close to discovering the true nature of his world until now?
We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
In the beginning of The Truman Show, a star falls from the sky. Well, A light falls from the ceiling of a sky-high set that encloses an artificial town built for the life of one man and the entertainment of the whole world. The light says Sirius 9 Canis Major, which refers to Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky. This star, which Homer once called an evil portent, bringing heat and fevers to suffering humanity. In the film, the falling of Sirius is the first in a series of ruptures in Truman's fake reality, a series that ends here with an actual rupture, a breach in things as they are. Like in Homer, Peter Weir, director of The Truman Show, envisions this door into real reality in darker terms than you might expect. All the symbols we usually associate with goodness and positivity are behind Truman. Bright blue skies, sunbeams breaking through the clouds, an expansive sea of possibility. Reality, truth, and authenticity, on the other hand, are relegated to a small, single rectangle of shadow, hardly the light at the end of the tunnel that we normally associate with liberation. All throughout the film, freedom for Truman is linked tightly with trauma. Every peek behind the curtain is accompanied by some form of pain, whether it's the pain of seeing the image of a deceased loved one, the pain of a true connection abruptly cut short, the pain of memory, or simply the pain of uncertainty, of not knowing what it is you're seeing. That's, of course, a pain that we're all familiar with. It's why, for the most part, we see only what we want to see. Truman has been privy to a lifetime full of hints, clues to the fact that his world is not as it seems.
Truman! It's television! Yes!
But to incorporate those clues means to reconfigure the entire narrative of his existence. And rewrites like that just aren't free. They cost. They cost suffering. Peter Weir and writer Andrew Niccol were prophetic about so much from the vantage of 1998. The ubiquity of reality television, the rise of mass surveillance, they keyed in perfectly to my parents' generation of Cold War paranoia, of being watched or bugged, and my own generation of narcissism, where it bugs us not to be watched. That's a great joy of The Truman Show. The allegories and layered readings, the headiness of it all, stands out vividly, even for a kid like I was when I saw it at age 10. It's not pedantic or preachy, it just asks so many damn questions that they're impossible to ignore.
What the hell are you talking about? Who are you talking to?
And actually, I was watching it again recently, and I was really struck by how easily The Truman Show can be read as an allegory for the present. Like Truman's town of Sea Haven, our own world seems to be experiencing a similar series of ruptures. Ruptures like the Great Recession in 2008, the Arab Spring, like the killings of young black men by police or our increasing awareness of them, like Brexit, the splitting of the UK from Europe, and most recently like the rise of the political outsider movements of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. I think American society at large is a lot like Truman Burbank, laboring like him for 30 plus years under a system that is finally showing itself to be ridiculous. Society, like Truman, is trying to wake itself up while stumbling under the pain that surfaces from doing so. The Truman Show is a massive operation with a crew and cast of thousands, but for all the power that Christoph commands, the show's success always hinges on Truman himself. It can only work if Truman believes in it.
He could leave at any time. If he was absolutely determined to discover the truth, there's no way we could prevent him.
The powerful in our world hold things in place like Christoph holds Truman, but we hold ourselves in place, too. If nothing else, it's clear that in 2016, we are slowly waking up into a new political reality. Like in Truman's world, the power relationships of our own have gained and consolidated strength by convincing us that they're normal, like laws of nature. By taking any breach and folding it back into the narrative, they've kept all those like Truman, who are perennial losers, at bay. But ideologies don't last forever. Eventually, they crumble under their own weight and the increasing refusal of people to believe in them.
Thank you for your help.
You're welcome, Truman.
The Truman Show shows us what waking up looks like. It stages in a really valuable way the struggles that come with it. It shows how the messaging of the dominant ideology is absorbed into media and into education. It shows us how individual people, even people we trust, good people, can become the mouthpieces of a rotten system.
If everybody is in on it, I'd have to be in on it too.
And most importantly of all, The Truman Show imagines liberation, not as utopia, but as a world flawed like our own, full of multiplicity and contradiction, and people obsessed with TV. It's a world gained only by struggle and pain, one that often looks like an evil portent in the moment. It's not a sunburst in the clouds or an endless sea, but a small shadowy door that leads off to a territory unmapped, but invested, hopefully, with a greater authenticity.
In case I don't see ya, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
The parallels are uncanny. For me, many works of art look completely different on this side of the fence since crawling out of Mormonism. The Truman Show, The Matrix, Pleasantville, Tangled, V for Vendetta, George Orwell's 1984, and Animal Farm, Flatland. If you've seen these movies or read these books before your transition, watch and read them again. It's quite the experience looking again through the eyes of understanding. Empty your cup to make room for more wisdom. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Be the scout. Be open. Be curious. Seek to understand. Celebrate when you're wrong because you've discovered something right. Don't be a square. Smoke out and escape any two-dimensional thinking you're still holding on to. Transcend to the freedom and liberation of 3, 4, 5, and beyond dimensional thinking. Sing and dance. There is no journey. There is no destination. Own yourself. Own your authority. Pay the price. It's just worth it. Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way. As I lay there that dark night, lit by the fire and the stars, I began to drift asleep and start to dream a dream. I saw myself that I was in a dark and dreary waste. I traveled for the space of many hours in the darkness, and I started to be afraid. I kept walking, and I came to a large and spacious field. I saw a tree that was white, which exceeded all the whiteness that I had ever seen. As I looked around, I saw a river of water, and it ran along, and it was near the tree. I also saw a rod of iron, and it extended along the bank of the river and led to the tree. I also saw a straight and narrow path which came along by the rod of iron, even to the tree. And it also led to the head of a fountain on a large and spacious field as if it had been a world. I pressed forward that I might obtain the path which led to the tree. And as I pressed forward, there arose a mist of darkness, a great mist of darkness that seemed to try to pull me away from the rod of iron that I held tightly onto. As I continued to press forward through the mist of darkness, clinging to the rod of iron, I looked around and saw on the other side of the river of water a great and spacious building. It was a building that appeared to be 28 stories tall, with a weird sphere on the front of it. It was filled with people, mostly old, mostly male, white and delightsome. Their manner of dress was exceedingly fine, and they were in the attitude of mocking and scoffing. One of the apostles, Dallin, held up a sign in my direction, which had a bizarre question. One of these men terrified me with his anger. He kept screaming something over and over, with occasional spit shooting out of his mouth. as I squinted my eyes to be able to read his lips, it was as if he was saying, I'm so taffy furious. I'm so taffy furious. I'm so taffy furious. I was shaken by the anger and hostility of that man. I quickly shifted my attention to another part of this great and spacious building. These angry men were shouting at me. You didn't study enough. You didn't have a testimony. You didn't study enough. I shifted my eyes away from the terrifying scene back to the tree. As I walked closer to the tree, I saw a kind and wise older man waiting for me. His presence immediately restored peace. I'm not sure if he was my older self or my higher self, but there was love in his eyes, and I felt as if he knew me very, very well. I asked this kind and wise man about all those prayers, all my seeking, all my studying, all my fasting, all those times that I sought help from a higher power in my life. Who was listening? Who was answering? Who was helping? And this kind and wise man looked at me with love in his voice. And he said, it was you all along. Thank you. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. So I'm going to move on to the second part of my presentation in just 5 minutes. What I would like to do is I would like to give you an update on CES letter-related projects and stuff. So after we do this, it's just 5 minutes, we're going to start the Q&A. But with the CES letter stuff, the first thing is that for those of you who are unaware, there's a new website. It's on cesletter.org. There's the .com, but I'm moving away from the .com over to .org because CES Letter Foundation is now a nonprofit, and it just makes sense to do that. I want to give a shout-out to Craig Keeling for designing this website. Excellent work. This site is responsive and mobile-friendly. That's one of the issues that I ran into with the older site. It's not mobile-friendly, so I was getting penalized by Google for not being mobile-friendly. So check it out, cesletter.org. As many of you already know, CES Letter Foundation is now a 501c3 nonprofit. And I did this for several reasons. I consulted with attorneys and experts who advised me that it was wise to separate myself from the CES Letter for liability reasons, for preserving the brand. So if I were to get hit by Daniel Peterson's taper, or get an aneurysm from one of Brian Hale's latest apologetics, there are others. There's a board that can continue this. They have passwords. They have instructions. So it just made sense to just do this through a foundation. Translations. I have Spanish completed, Portuguese completed, German, Japanese, Finnish. I'm in the process with Swedish, French, Italian. I'm looking for help on Filipino and Tongan and Korean for those out there that speak those languages. Next thing I'm going to move over, this is the paperback CES letter that I'm looking to launch on November 15th. And you can order on cesletter.org. The way that I have it set up there is it's based on what is called a pay what you want model. So I don't name a price. I just ask that you cover the cost of the book and shipping. So if that's, you know, I'm happy if you just take that. And I'm not asking for a specific amount. It's just pay what you want. The updated CES letter, what I'm looking to do is to be as effective as I can. When I wrote the CES letter, I was in a different stage in my life. You can sense some of the emotional turmoil, you know, when I wrote that. And I'm obviously in a different stage in my life. I've set up a new system for sources and links. There's hyperlinks in the CES letter. Some of them are broken links. So what I've set up is what is called a redirect. I don't want to be too complicated, but basically it ties with the server. And so basically all that matters, all you need to know is that this makes it easy for me to immediately update links, broken links, so that the CES letter is as updated and effective as it can be. The CES logo. Some people have asked me what the meaning or symbolism behind it, and I just wanted to read this real quick. The hazel leaf has been a symbol for wisdom in some mythologies, and paradoxically, hazel twigs are believed to be imbued with talisman power, used as divining rods to find water, oil, and treasure buried in the earth or out of normal sight. Most things in life have two sides to them, two sides to a story, perspective, or belief. CES Letter Foundation represents, in this approach, the other side of the narrative, the logical and evidence-based side over the superstitious, without throwing away everything out the window to start over. Readers of the CES Letter find themselves on a path where foggy thinking about the reality fades away, and wisdom and clarity come into view as one moves out of superstition that we may or may not have known was there prior. The CES letter is the product of clarity and about asking honest questions. Even though we are unable to change the path behind us, we can move forward focusing on the wisdom that the hazel leaf represents, with the reminder and warning that wisdom can be corrupted by superstition if we let our intellectual curiosity fade. Moving on, social media. I made a big effort in ramping up and expanding our social media. Craig Keeling has done a fantastic job in helping to run the media, especially on the Instagram side. So please like our Facebook page, Twitter, feel free to follow, and Instagram, there's some great stuff on there. So feel free to follow on Instagram as well. Resonation. So I don't know about you guys, but like, it was a pain in the ass. It really was. It was a really difficult process. A lot of documentation went into that. I wanted to show the world how the Mormon Church treats its questioners and its doubters. And I believe, as far as I know, it's the most documented LDS court ever. So this image, for those of you who can't see, state president saying, anything to say before I excommunicate you? Yes, I excommunicate you. Damn. So I found that. I think Stephen Fisella shared it to me. I laughed and laughed. So, now what? For some damn reason, it's always an email sent to me around 3 o'clock in the morning. It's always 3 o'clock. I don't know why it's 3 o'clock, not 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock. It's 3 o'clock. And the question I often get asked is, now what? how do I deal with my family? How do I deal with my wife? Now what? What am I going to do with my life in terms of this new information? How am I going to handle it? So what I've done is I've written in what I hope to be a very straightforward and simple guide to help people in that dangerous and critical time. This is going to be launched on November 15th. Again, this is a pay-what-you-want model. So this is going to be digital. If you don't want to pay for it or you can't afford to pay for it, you still get it. I just think it's fair. I'm more concerned about it being accessible to people. So nowwhatbook.com. You can put in your email address to be notified when it gets launched. News and podcasts, just an interesting, like, I really was stretched outside my comfort zone this year and being interviewed by the press and doing podcasts. So some of the news that I've been a part of as a result of this, being able to expose, well, not expose, but to share the CES letter and some of the, basically the church's truth crisis. Podcasts, of course, Mormon Stories. I've been asked about the future, what my future plans are. For the last few years, I have tried to get official answers from the LDS Church. I have tried to get honesty out of the LDS Church. I am now focused on helping people affected by the church's truth crisis. I'm passionate about providing better resources and in doing what I can to alleviate unnecessary suffering and anguish in individuals, marriages, and families. So three areas of focus is one is accessibility, the translations, getting this outside the United States so that the poor folks in Guatemala stop paying for City Creek and likewise your state park. Effectiveness, again, like updating the CES letter and all this other paperback book, new website, focusing on being as effective as I can. Resources, getting the word out through Mormon Spectrum, which is an excellent organization. Steve and Chris are here. Fantastic organization. Mormon Transitions, fantastic for what they're doing. John DeLand, Mormon Mental Health. Natasha Parker. I'm focused on healing and growth, so I don't care about the church anymore. I care about helping people to climb out and transcend Mormonism. Special thanks. Very, very special thanks to my donors and supporters. From the bottom of my heart, I really appreciate your support and kindness and generosity. It has really helped me to be able to do the things I just mentioned, as well as the things I want to do. There are other things that I haven't mentioned that are more little details, but it really, really has helped. Thank you so much. I want to thank Craig Keeling. He's my designer. He did the website. He did the book cover for CS Letter, book cover for Now What, a lot of the graphics, social media. This guy is very, very talented. GregKeeling.com. I highly recommend you check him out or if you need his services. I want to give a shout out to Blake Buse. He's the code ninja on the team. Any coding problems or whatever, I just text him and say, hey, I need help, and he's on it. Fantastic guy. I want to give a shout out to John DeLand and Mormon Stories for being there when I needed him. During the whole excommunication fiasco, he was behind the scenes giving me advice and encouragement and recommendations. So much love, John. Thank you so much for being there and helping me out. Everybody clap for John for what he's done for the Mormon Transparency Movement. I want to thank Tom Phillips and Mormon Think. As the CES letter was going viral, Tom Phillips, as the editor at the time with Mormon Think, made the decision to put CES letter in Mormon Think, and that took it to a whole new level. So thank you, Tom. He really has done a lot. I want to thank Grant Palmer. His book was extremely profound for me during my climbing out of Mormonism. He's doing excellent work. I want to thank Johnny Stevenson. He's not well known, but as far as I'm concerned, he's the top Mormon polygamy expert. This guy is making Brian Hales look like an asshole. I'm sorry, but when you read his stuff and see that the stuff that he's discovered, Brian, he's just doing amazing work. I highly recommend that you look it up. He has discovered things about polygamy that, in some cases, really shows that Brian Hales has not been honest or forthcoming in his claims and apologetics. So big shout out to Johnny Stevenson for his amazing, amazing scholarship. Big shout out to Jonathan Streeter. He's here. He's in the back over there. Thoughts on Things and Stuff. This guy cranks out quality. He's one of the smartest people I know. I really appreciate his advice and thoughts. Just a great guy. Big shout out to Jim Whitefield. When I was in the early days of debunking fairs, he really came through for me in terms of giving me encouragement and suggestions and advice. So I highly recommend you look into his books. Great guy. Shout out to Dan Vogel for his work and encouragement and thoughts. Shout out to Bob Hayden, who is Flacker Man on YouTube. Great videos he cranked out. Shout out to Simon Southerton for his work. Shout out to Fair Mormon. Fair has done more than any man or any organization to bring people out of the church. They're the biggest anti-Mormons on the internet. Like, they're the gateway to ex-Mormonism. And what they've done for the CES letter, I just can't thank them enough for. So thank you, Fair. Hi, Scott Gordon. I want to give a shout-out to ex-Mormon subreddit. We appreciate the support that you guys have given me over the years, especially Mithrin and Curious Mormon. Shout out to Mormon Infographics and Bart for some of his graphics have made the CES letter much more effective. So big shout out to him. Shout out to Just Another Apostate. She really is an effective communicator. If you haven't seen her stuff on Instagram, I highly recommend you check it out. Shout out to the Ex-Mormon Foundation. I'm grateful for the platform that you guys provide every year for us to be able to come together and to share stories and to listen to presenters, and thank you. I'll give a shout out to my dad. Here we go again. So he was one of the guys that came to rescue me during my apostasy and with my grandpa. And, there was kind of a little falling out for a year or so, like kind of coldness. But he decided to follow his integrity and look into things. And I want to give a heartfelt appreciation and thanks to the church for releasing the Blacks in the Priesthood essay. He read that, and it really disturbed him and started his process to where he eventually resigned a couple months ago. So So he's been behind the scenes, giving me lots of encouragement and advice, and really appreciate him. Okay. And last of all, I want to thank my wife. So much patience, and she never gave me any ultimatums. Just encouraged me to follow my heart and to seek truth wherever it's found. So, love you. Thank you for your support. Any questions?
We're going to have to take a break, and it was due to come right now. So let's have a couple of questions, and then if you want to talk to Jeremy, you can use this break time to do it, and don't forget again tomorrow morning. So I guess I can take this one.
Besides the excommunication, have you faced any backlash? I've heard that Lindsay Hansen Park had to move because her family was experiencing death threats. Anything like that? Lucked out.
Are you asking if he knows that?
So just make sure that I understand the question is, have I felt threatened?
Yeah.
Okay. So no, I haven't. I'm actually pretty surprised about Lindsay's situation. That's actually crazy. But I've never felt threatened or whatever. My experience has been a lot different. I'm sorry to hear that she's had to go through that.
Yeah, one more.
I just want to really thank you. I feel like you're like the Martin Luther for the universe, for the LDS Church. And I just think that's fantastic.
Thank you.
One of the things I wanted to ask is, when I was sharing the LDS or the CES letter with my son, one of his criticisms was, he says he feels like he's not even Christian, and I was wondering if you can help me understand how to share that in a way that's beneficial.
Yeah, sure. You have to understand the background story, so. I didn't write the CES letter when I was still in the church thinking about whether, I want to stay or not. The CES letter came as a result of my grandfather asking his CES director friend to come after me and basically rescue me and bring me back to the church. And so, when he asked, the CES director asked me to lay out my concerns and questions, I did that. And if you read the beginning of the CES letter, there's a part where I say, I'm just going to lay it out. I'm just going to lay it out of how I'm seeing things. Show me where I'm wrong. Help me understand how my perspective is wrong, basically. And so that's kind of how that angle came about. So I really was looking for official answers from the CES director at that time. There were no essays. So he was basically, to me, the only source I had for official answers. And this was after a year of just absolute frustration of reading apologetics and Fair Mormon and all that stuff. I was tired of their philosophies of men mingled with scripture, and I just wanted official answers. So that's kind of the angle that went about.